Welcome to the weekly live broadcast of Gnostic Radio, a free public service from Telema Press. Each Saturday, Gnostic Radio broadcasts free lectures from the Gnostic tradition of Samael on Vior. Gnosis is the essential wisdom from which all religions have been born. Gnosis is the universal doctrine, containing the precise science to free the soul from suffering. Each lecture explores another aspect of this timeless and sacred knowledge. Listeners are encouraged to participate in the live chat session via AOL's instant messaging software, available for free on the web. Simply download and install this software and send a message to Gnostic School in order to be included in the chat session. Participants are able to send in questions about the lecture, which will be answered in the broadcast. Participation is free and completely anonymous. For more information about Gnosis, these lectures, or how to install the AOL software, you can visit the website of Telema Press at www.gnosis-usa.com. Now, with heartfelt wishes for the end of all suffering, we present today's lecture. May all beings be happy. Good morning. We're going to continue our introduction to the book of Genesis, or the book of Revelation, actually. Continuing from the lecture of last week. In the Bible, we know that there are two important books related to the tradition of alchemy. And these two books are Genesis and Revelation. Alchemy and Kabbalah are the two great sciences that the initiate needs to understand in order to walk on the path, in order to return back to Eden. And these two sciences of alchemy and Kabbalah are symbolized in the book of Genesis. Alchemy is symbolized as the tree of knowledge, which is in Hebrew called Da'at, D-A-A-T-H. And the Kabbalah is symbolized in the book of Genesis as the tree of life. These two trees represent the science, or the precise wisdom, the precise knowledge that one needs in order to come to know God, to come to the freedom of suffering, freedom from suffering. So when we study gnosis, of course that's a Greek word which means knowledge, and this corresponds directly to this word da'at in Hebrew, which is the tree of knowledge. And gnosis in itself really encompasses the knowledge of both trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and bad. The books of Genesis and Revelation are the vehicles of that knowledge. They are an encoding of that information, of that wisdom. So when we examine the book of Revelation, we have to bear in mind that we're studying something that is deeply symbolic. And we cannot take it simply at the literal level. So, as was explained in the previous lecture, when we look at the seven churches, for example, that are mentioned by the writer John, he says seven churches in Asia. But we know that when you study Kabbalah, you understand that it is not Asia that's
written there, it's Asya, which is the physical world, the kingdom. And those seven churches are symbolic of seven magnetic centers that exist in the physical body and in the other internal bodies that we have. In the same way, the other symbols, names, and words of the book of Revelation are symbolic. And they indicate to us precise means to come to the knowledge that the book is indicating. So, alchemy and Kabbalah form the foundation for the initiate. They provide the ground upon which the path can be realized. So this ground is the fundamental understanding that every initiate needs in order to work in the right way. Kabbalah in itself, or the Tree of Life, is more or less a map. It's a symbol. And some listeners may have a copy of the Tree of Life, an image, could be a book or a poster. And this tree encodes in its structure a map that demonstrates both how the consciousness works and how nature works. And for the initiate, for the student, for the aspirant, to really come to know directly the knowledge that's contained in the book of Revelation, that person must understand the Tree of Life. Because the book of Revelation is in itself expressing the knowledge of the Tree of Life. So if you don't have a good understanding of how the tree works, of how Kabbalah works, you can never understand the book of Revelation. Likewise, the book of Genesis, or for that matter, the rest of the Bible. This symbol encodes that knowledge. It places it into a visual form, which then indicates structures, relationships. And those relationships and structures exist within our own psyche. They're within us. They demonstrate how our own psychological systems function. So it's necessary for the initiate to understand that structure. When we look in the book of Revelation, and we study this text, we read this text, we see that the language is very dreamlike. The language is very poetic. It's very rhythmic in a certain way. It has a kind of structure, a kind of tone, which makes it different from the rest of the Bible. And this tone, this style, is due to the language from which it was written. See, Revelation, like the book of Genesis, is an expression of this Kabbalistic knowledge, or this root knowledge. So the tone and language within which the book is written demonstrates that it contains something more than simply the printed word. So when we read, for example, the book says, I turned, I saw seven standing lamps of gold, and among the lamps one like a son of man, robed down to his feet, with a golden girdle around his breast. To take that literally leaves the reader very dissatisfied. Because it doesn't, on a literal level, it doesn't express the real content of the book. To just imagine some radiant person is not enough. The book of Revelation is a sacred book precisely because it demonstrates and communicates a science, something practical, not merely something to be believed. And that's really the nature of gnosis or thought. It is something practical, something that we have to utilize. Unfortunately, most readers of the Bible and most readers of the book of Revelation fail to grasp that because they don't have the keys. So in this tradition, we study Gnosis, the Tree of Life, and we study alchemy in order to grasp those keys and use them to unlock the symbols that are contained in this book. So, to have that ability to unlock the symbols, we have to understand something about the Tree of Life. So if we imagine, visualize for ourselves, one sphere, one circle, and we place upon that sphere the name Malkut. It's M-A-L-K-U-T-H. And this is a Hebrew word that means the kingdom. This single sphere is a symbol, like an algebraic symbol or a mathematical symbol, which represents many things. But in the case of what we're going to look at in this lecture, we'll say that this circle represents our physical body, represents us as a person. So you who are listening, who are seated inside of a physical vehicle, are symbolized by this circle of Malkut. And that circle rests or hangs from a triangle. And that triangle also has a sphere at each point. So now we have in our imagination a single sphere hanging by itself, above which is a triangle pointed downwards. And that triangle symbolizes a deeper part of ourselves. It symbolizes our psyche, aspects of our own psychological structure. So if we have this physical body, which is symbolized by Malkut, we have within ourselves energy, which is that first sphere closest to Malkut, at the bottom of the downward hanging triangle. That sphere is called Yesod, which means the foundation. The top two spheres at either end of the triangle, the one on the left is called Hod, and the one on the right is called Netzach. Yesod, or the lowest sphere of these three above Malkut, represents the energy that we have, and this is often called the vital body or the etheric body. This is the energy that gives life or gives force to the physical body that we have. So in a certain sense, you could say, within that sphere of Malkut, which is by itself, we have Yesod. But symbolically, we show it above it and separate from it in order for our mind to understand. Past Yesod, the next sphere would be Hod, the one up to the upper left. And Hod is related to our astral energy or emotional energy. And next to that, to the right of it, is Netzach, which is related to the mind, to the intellect, to thought. In Sanskrit, Netzach is called Manas, inferior Manas. And this is related to the mind that we have. Above this triangle is another downward pointed triangle. And the lowest sphere, the lowest point of that triangle, has another sphere. And this one is called Tipperet. And this one is Manas proper. This is the actual Manas, superior Manas in Sanskrit. Manas is a term which means mind or intellect, more literally. But it's not intellect in the way we normally think of it. In Netzach, we have a kind of mind that's more concrete. It's more rational. And in Tipperet, we have a kind of mind that's more intuitive or abstract. So you can see that as we move further away from Malkut, we're dealing with more and more subtle forms of psyche, more and more subtle forms of energy. What we're looking at is the very the lowest half, the lowest structure, the lowest five spheres of the tree of life. These five represent what Paul calls the terrestrial man. So when we're reading in the book of Revelation about John, John is really representing a part of our psyche related to the terrestrial man. And this part of our psyche is receiving instruction, is receiving wisdom from another entity, from another intelligence. So these five spheres are important for us to understand, in order for us to understand the book of Revelation. Because as you descend into the symbolism of the Kabbalah as presented in the book of Revelation, it can become quite complicated and quite dense. So these five spheres provide a sort of basic structure upon which a great deal of the book can be understood. Now these five, as well as representing different levels of our own psyche, more and more subtle levels of thought, more and more subtle levels of any kind of psychological process, they also represent the vehicles of those forms of thought, or those forms of communication. So on the physical level, the lowest sphere of Malkut represents this physical body that we have, through which we receive certain kinds of information, and within which we perform certain kinds of action. Likewise, when we move a level, a more subtle level, into the level of Yesod, we have a body of energy, or a body of chi. This is the foundation, this is Yesod. Upon this foundation is built everything. Yesod, or the vital body, is the cause of life of the physical body. You cannot have a physical body without energy, without a vital body. So in the same way that we act with our physical body, that action is empowered by the energy of the vital body. And that action is fulfilled by that same force. So we can act physically, we can also act energetically. We can act in other levels. And so we understand in Gnosis that not only do we have this physical body and the capacity to act on that level, we have a vital body or a body of energy, and we have the capacity to act on that level as well. We may not realize it. We may not be aware of it, but it exists. In the same way, the more we ascend through these spheres, we find the capacity to act in different ways. So in Hod, related to the astral body, related to emotion, that sphere has its vehicle. It has a body. It has a means by which action is expressed. That action can be perceived in different ways. If we're seated inside of our physical vehicle, this physical body related to Malkut, we have emotional action or communication or action, things that we perform related to our emotions, and that's related to the astral body or the sphere of Hod. But if we are outside of the physical body, in the same way that John is in the book of Revelation, John is taken up in the spirit, outside of the physical body, in order to receive that revelation. In that way, he's acting with other vehicles, not the physical one. So here we see, expressed in this portion of the Tree of Life, different vehicles of varying densities, existing in varying levels of nature, which each provide the capacity to act in its own way. So the astral body is our ability to act and communicate in the astral world. Otherwise, we call it the fifth dimension. And this same fifth dimension, we have the mental body, or the capacity to act through the vehicle of thought. This is Netzah. More subtle still is the abstract mind, or the body of conscious will, which is Tipperet, which is even in a more subtle level of nature, the sixth dimension. So these varying levels or varying vehicles that we all have provide to us means to receive and transmit action. information, wisdom. And it's upon the basis of these vehicles that the work of the path of self-realization is accomplished. This is one of the most fundamental points that Gnosis offers to the initiate. The path to realize the true nature of self, the true nature of existence, cannot be realized merely physically. It cannot be realized merely through belief. That path is a work of action, and it is a work of creation. But it's realized through successive levels of our own interior makeup. That is symbolized in the book of Genesis by the days of creation. We know that there are 6 days within which God creates the man, and on the seventh he rests. These 7 days are related to these spheres, plus 2 more. The first 5 days of Genesis are related to these 5 spheres. So it's important for any person who really wants to understand how to conquer suffering and how to enter into direct knowledge of the divine to understand very well what these 5 spheres are within ourselves. What truly is the physical body? How does it come to be? What empowers it? What enlivens it? What truly is the mind? What is emotion? What is a dream? What is it to pay attention? These questions have to be understood on the basis of the Tree of Life, because the Tree of Life is what organizes this information into a useful structure. Without that, it's easy to become trapped in theories and contradictory ideas. So when we examine the book of Revelation, we have to keep in mind the structure. Reason being, this first chapter of the book of Revelation is the introduction both of John as the author and as the person who represents us, the initiate, and the Christ who's giving the wisdom. To understand that relationship is only possible on the basis of knowing what the Tree of Life is and how it works. Without that knowledge, this book becomes just a narrative which sounds like a dream and has no real impact on our moment-to-moment existence. So if we extend the tree that we've already outlined and go deeper into the structure of our psyche, we can start to understand what John means when he writes Son of Man. Because this is also a very important thing, a very important term for us to understand. So these first 5 spheres represent us. Beyond this, we have deeper parts of our psyche, which really correspond to more superior levels of the being, more superior parts of our own soul. The second triangle that we've drawn has 2 more spheres on either end. The first one on the left is called Geburah, and this is the divine soul. Or in Sanskrit, it's called Buddhi. Buddhi literally means intelligence. And this intelligence is differentiated from manas, which means intellect. In the same way that you can understand the difference between fire and light. Fire would be tipperet. It's the flame that arises. But that flame, that fire, emits light. And that light would be buddhi, the more subtle part of the fire. Buddhi is one aspect of our soul. And the other sphere on this triangle is called chesed. It's also called gejula. And this sphere is called in Sanskrit Atman. Now in Gnosis, we understand Atman in a different way from Hinduism. Because the modern Hindu conception of Atman limits this sense of self to being the absolute self. to being the root of the self. And in Gnosis, we go further than that. Like in Buddhism, Buddhism contests the Hindu or Brahmanic understanding of Atman. And Gnosis agrees with Buddhism that Atman is not limited to simply the ultimate definition of self. It is truly our self, but it is not the root of self. Because this self of Atman has its own self. It goes deeper. So Atman, or Chesed, we would say, is what we would call in Christianity our father, our individual father, or the root, the being that we have, our own inner being, our own inner self. But this inner self, Chesed, or Atman, also has his own inner self. And that spirit, we could also say, arises due to yet another triangle, which sits atop the top of this one. So we have in our imagination now one solitary sphere which hangs at the bottom. Above it is a downward-facing triangle. Above that is another downward-facing triangle. And above that is one more, which faces upward, points upward. This superior triangle is the top of the tree of life. It also has three spheres, one on each end for each point. And this superior triangle, or supernal triangle, is the triangle of the Logos. This triangle represents what's classically known as the Trinity, or the Trimurti. Trimurti is a Sanskrit term which means three-faced. And if you examine Hinduism, they have a very good understanding of what a Trimurti is. You'll see sculptures of one god with three faces. That is the Trinity. It is one, but with three aspects. So we have to understand, what is this Trinity or Trimurti? A trinity is a tri-unity, or three in one. And this is, of course, in Christianity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. In Hinduism, it is Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. In Kabbalah, we call these the three logos, first, second, and third. In Hebrew, the leftmost bottom sphere is called Bina, which means understanding. The right bottom sphere is called Chokmah, which means wisdom. And the top is called Keter, which means the crown. These three are one. They are three aspects of the same force. And these three in one, in Gnosis we call the cosmic Christ. Christ, of course, is a universal force. When we say Christ, we don't mean the same thing that the Christians mean. We're not referring to Jesus of Nazareth, to one person, to one vehicle of the Christ. We agree that Jesus of Nazareth is a great initiate. No question about that. But we also add that he was not the only one. We add, we understand, Krishna was also a Christ, an embodiment or a vehicle of this three-in-one, this force. Muhammad was also a vehicle of the Christ. Quetzalcoatl was also a vehicle of the Christ. Moses. There have been many, not just one. We have to understand that this force, this Christic energy, is in its base expression, love. But it is not the kind of love that we as a terrestrial person can understand. Because our understanding of love is rooted in materialism, is rooted in matter, is rooted in sensation. So when we think of love, we tend to think of something that's conditional, that's based on certain conditions or circumstances. This is not love. Love, truly, is an energy or a force which is beyond any conceptual understanding that we could ever have. Because a conceptual understanding is limited to manas, to the intellect. Even in the abstract sense, when we use abstract mind, tipperet, if that tipperet, that abstract mind, is not unified with that cosmic Christ, it cannot comprehend love. It cannot understand it. In order to understand the Christic energy, that force, that energy, that Christ, has to become humanized in us. We have to experience that. And that's the only way to understand what it is. So when we indicate cosmic Christ, we have to understand that we're talking about something in an intellectual or conceptual way that can never really be understood in that way. As much as we build a nice structure in our mind about what this means, it is not the thing itself. That force, the cosmic Christ, arises and manifests driven by its own impulse of love. And that love is characterized in different ways and expressed in different ways through each of its three aspects. But in the context of the book of Revelation, we have to understand that this force of love expresses itself in this book as the Son of Man. So what is that? Who is that? What does Son of Man mean? In the Bible, when you examine Son of Man, you find this term all over. And it has subtle differences depending on which book it's in, where it's placed. In the early parts of the Bible, the original Hebrew for Son of Man is Ben Adam. Later, in the book of Psalms, it's Ben Enosh. In the later books, in the New Testament, it's in Greek. So, in each case, we have subtle differences, but the indication is always the same. If you look in the Gospels, we find that the great teacher Jesus refers to the Son of Man often. But he says it in a way that's very interesting. He never says, I. He talks about the Son of Man in the sense that it is him and it's not him. He says, the Son of Man will be persecuted and will rise again. But he's talking about himself, but he's not talking about himself. Why is that? The reason is because he's not the only one. The Son of Man is a symbol, and it's a symbol of how the force of the cosmic Christ expresses itself through Chokmah, the second logos, which is the Son. That force, that energy, becomes humanized in the initiate. And the way that happens is very unusual and somewhat rare. That force descends through this tree, and at a certain stage of the initiatic process of a given person, that force becomes born in that person's heart. And that force becomes humanized. And this is symbolized when Jesus is born in the stable amongst the animals. The animals, of course, symbolize the elements that we have in our mind, the impure elements, all the animalistic forms that we have within our psyche. And that cosmic Christ, humanized, is born as that child in the stable. In order for an initiate to receive that type of blessing, the initiate has to accomplish certain tasks. It is not simply a matter of believing in the Christ for that Christic force to become born in us. Many people think that way. Millions of people believe. But among them, can we find the Christ? Living, breathing, acting, sacrificing. Chokmah in Hebrew means wisdom. In Sanskrit, wisdom is bodhi, B-O-D-H-I. When that force becomes humanized, when it enters into a person, that person becomes something different, something new, something distinct. This force of Chokmah, this force of the cosmic Christ, has as its very essence love. But this force, as expressed through Chokmah, through the second logos, expresses through its law, which is sacrifice. The force, the will of the Christic energy is sacrifice, love. And this is perfectly illustrated in the initiatic drama that Jesus lived. He sacrificed himself completely for the good of others. In Hinduism, certain forms, but more specifically in Buddhism, this type of person is called a bodhisattva. Sattva means essence of, or embodiment of, or vehicle. Bodhi is wisdom. But bodhi indicates Chokmah, the Christ. So a bodhisattva is the essence of the Christ, or a vehicle of the Christ, an embodiment of that force. So we then would say, Jesus was a great bodhisattva. Moses is a great bodhisattva. Quetzalcoatl, Muhammad, Krishna, all these teachers, great bodhisattvas, embodiments of Christ, vehicles of Christ, who are not that, but are. The Son of Man is that Christic force humanized in Tipperet, in the human soul, in manas, in the mind, inside of our hearts and minds, inside of us as a person. This accomplishment is achieved by the initiate, who firstly works on a daily basis with true alchemy, the science of the tree of knowledge, and who works on a daily basis with the knowledge present in the Kabbalah, or the tree of life. When someone is working with the science of alchemy, and working with the science of the tree of life, they begin a process to fill each sphere of the tree of life in themselves with fire. And that fire is the fire of the Holy Spirit, also the fire of the Christ, because those two are one. But in essence, the initiate has to work with alchemy in order to raise in Malkut what we call a serpent of fire. In other words, in Sanskrit, it's called Kundalini. And in the book of Numbers, Moses explains that this is the serpent of brass. Now, brass is a very important symbol in alchemy, because brass is a combination of two metals, copper and tin. And this is an alchemical symbol, which is demonstrating that when you bond these two metals, copper and tin, which one is masculine, one is feminine, these two, merged, blended, represent the man and the woman, male and female. Those two, merged with purity, can create brass. And in the book of Numbers, we know that the serpent of brass heals the Israelites of their spiritual problems, of their what's symbolized there as death and sickness. Now, in the book of Revelation, we see that the Son of Man is described as having feet which gleam like burnished brass refined in a furnace. The furnace is the athanor, or the matras, of the alchemist. It's the alchemical oven. And that oven is symbolized in the East as a lingam yoni. The oven is the laboratory of the alchemist. And in that oven is placed the metals, copper and tin. They are merged in purity. So the Son of Man, in the book of Revelation, his feet are burnished like brass. The feet are a symbol of Malkut. If we take this tree of life that we visualized, and we superimpose that on our own body, Malkut would be where our feet are. So we have to understand, the Son of Man becomes the Son of Man by working in alchemy, with an alchemical oven, with purity, to burnish the brass, to formulate the perfect bond of copper and tin in alchemy. That process raises upon the spinal column of the physical body a serpent of fire. And this is accomplished in the first great initiation of major mysteries. It's called the serpent of fire, the first serpent. Subsequently, the initiate has to do the same work through each sphere moving up. Each serpent is risen based upon ordeals and tests and proofs. Nothing is given freely, nothing is given easily. The process of alchemy is very demanding. What happens when you place elements into an oven? They're submitted to heat and pressure. They're submitted to being purified. And that process is not pleasant for the element that's inside the oven. It burns. In the same way, the initiate is tested. And this, of course, is well represented in the book of Job. Job is tested quite severely. And this well represents what the initiate must pass through. Psychological tests. This is because we as a mind, as a creature, have many elements inside of our psyche which do not belong. If we study the Gospels closely, we see that that vehicle of the Christ, Jesus, indicated repeatedly, we cannot be adulterers and enter heaven. We cannot be liars. We cannot be murderers. We cannot be impure in any way. So all the impurities that we have within cannot just be ignored. They cannot just be forgotten. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that our sins will just disappear. They must be comprehended. They must be understood. They must be removed. And this is accomplished through examining them in detail. And we examine them in detail when they arise because we face problems. And that's why God allows Lucifer to test Job. to see how pure is he really? How good is he really? He seems good. He seems very devoted. But is he really in the depth? So Lucifer tempts him, punishes him, puts him in very difficult situations in order for all of those elements in his mind to be stimulated. So he puts heat and pressure. Job, of course, suffers intensely, if you're familiar with the book. But in the end, he proves himself because he has the capacity to analyze himself. He does not justify himself. He does not defend himself. He analyzes. He looks for what's wrong. He looks to change what he should change. The initiate must do the same. So with the process of arising, each serpent is the process of facing difficulties, tests, ordeals. And this is how our own inner being, Chesed, calls us, tests us to make sure that we are prepared to receive the blessing of the birth of the Christ within us. So little by little, as we change psychologically, as we remove from ourselves ways of thinking, ways of feeling, ways of behaving that are wrong, that are harmful, little by little, we incorporate more purity in ourselves. And that purity is really embodied in this fire. So we have then five great serpents related to these first five spheres. Each one a long and difficult work. Each one very demanding. And in the process of each one, many fail. Some keep trying, some walk away. With great patience, with great discipline, with great energy, some devoted ones arrive to the completion of the fifth serpent of fire. These ones have worked for a long time to purify different levels of their psyche of many problems, many mistakes, and to prove their discipline, to prove their willingness to change. In Sanskrit, this attitude, this action, is called atmayagna. And this term is very interesting. Yagna means sacrifice. Atma is related to atman, the self. So this term really means self-sacrifice. And it really indicates that the false self, or in other words, the I, the ego, has to be sacrificed. It has to die. And of course, this is perfectly represented in the crucifixion of the initiate. Upon the cross is placed first all of the elements that must die. Everything within us that is impure, that accrues karma, that causes suffering, and that is opposed to God must die. But that initiate has to sacrifice themselves, their very essence, the very fiber of who they are. And this is not something that is merely believed. It's an action. And this is not something that we will do someday. It has to be done on a moment-to-moment basis, according to our level, according to our capacity. The little sacrifices that we make, moment to moment, day to day, are preparing us for the great sacrifices that will be expected if we intend to incarnate the Christ. What is the basis upon which the sacrifice is made? It is the sacrifice of self-will. The I, the ego, is self-will. It is I who wants something. That desire, of course, is a polarity, a pendulum of like and dislike, craving and aversion. But in its essence, every desire is rooted in ego, and every ego is rooted in desire. So we have to understand, in order to perform this process, it is an ascending scale of greater and greater degrees of self-sacrifice. Now, some manage to walk a certain percentage of this road and maybe even reach this fifth serpent of fire and accomplish the arising of these five serpents and a certain percentage of purification. But all along they may still do it selfishly, more for their own benefit, more because they want to know God, or they want to have mystical experiences, or they want knowledge. Many accomplish this, and they teach according to the way they do it. And these teachers are called pratyekas in Sanskrit. In the Bible, they're called Pharisees. The Pharisee, or the pratyeka, is an initiate, is a person who's reached a certain degree of development, but rooted more in the sense of self, something for themselves, something that makes them feel empowered, makes them feel holy, makes them feel pure. This is all selfish. This type of person, the pratyeka, or what you could also call a nirvani, accomplishes this degree of development. In other terms, we can say they manage to create the solar bodies, astral, mental, and causal. They manage to reach a degree of development within which they have powers and they have a certain amount of understanding. But unfortunately, they have not utilized Atmayagna in its true sense, in its true meaning. They perform sacrifice to a degree. They offer their teachings. They try to help people. They may feed the sick, feed the poor, feed the hungry, take care of the sick. They may help people in the way that they're able to do it. But this type of person, this type of walker of the path, stops there. They feel quite pure, quite holy, and their teachings appear quite good. And they write many books, and they lead schools, and they run churches. And many of them are highly venerated by humanity and worshiped as saints. But they stop there. In order for an initiate to move beyond this stage, there has to be a great sacrifice. And what greater sacrifice can be made than to sacrifice one's own self? To give up material goods is good. To gather money and food and clothing for the poor and the sick and suffering is good. To assist in the spreading of any kind of good teaching for humanity is good. But what does it truly cost of oneself? To give is important, but to sacrifice is something else. To sacrifice means to give completely, to give without expectation, to give without connections, without expecting anything back, without conditions. The Master Jesus, in his story, just gave his time, gave his blood, gave his life. The great initiates of the East, Naropa, Padmasambhava, Krishna, gave and gave and gave. We read and study stories of initiates who gave and gave and gave at the expense of their own health, at the expense of their own livelihood, gave their lives. That is real sacrifice. So as the initiate works in each level, moving upwards, greater and greater degrees of sacrifice are expected. Some very few demonstrate the willingness to completely abandon their own self-will and to instead take on the will of the Christ and be an expression of that. To become an expression of the will of the Christ means to become the essence of sacrifice. That is the nature of a bodhisattva. Sattva is essence, bodhi is wisdom. But that wisdom is sacrifice in itself. To become the essence of sacrifice is not easy, because the entire ego that we have is opposed to that. Our ego wants to be comfortable, wants to be fed regularly and well, wants nice things, wants ease, wants things laid out in a very clear and comprehensible manner so we can understand everything that's happening and everything that will happen. The ego wants to know, is my spouse the right one for me? Am I doing the right thing? Is this the right job? What's going to happen in 6 months? What's going to happen in a year? Will I have a house? Will I have a job? Will I have a life? Will people like me? Selfish will. The ego wants to teach Gnosis, wants to teach Buddhism, wants to be respected, wants to be liked, wants to be admired, to be envied, wants to have a big school with lots of students. The ego, pride, likes to show itself. The Christ remains hidden. The Christ is born in the heart of a human being and is not visible. Pride wants to be seen. How can Christ be born in the heart of a prideful person? And yet, he is. Because the one who reaches the fifth initiation, who accomplishes the sacrifices required, and who receives that blessing, still has ego. That person enters into great contradiction, because they have something inside that's very pure and something inside that's very ugly. Everyone thinks they're a bodhisattva. Everyone wants to be a bodhisattva. Few understand the pain of that path. The great test, really, of the initiate who's accomplished the fifth great mystery, who stands in that position of making the choice, do I stay with the Nirvanis and walk this spiral path slowly, or do I take this direct path which is great sacrifice and pain. That one faces the choice that is truly incomprehensible. The one who takes the direct path pays all of their karma right away, is required to give up all sense of self, self-will, is required to completely abandon themselves and embody within themselves the will of Christ. Love, sacrifice. Unfortunately, most initiates, most students, walk these first few levels based on their own will or submitting themselves to the will of someone else. In many cases, we find students and initiates who never learn to act from their own will, who instead always seek advice, always seek to be told what to do. The beginner especially is a victim of this way of being, because not knowing the path, the beginner must seek and ask and look for instruction, and this is good. But this person needs to realize, the student needs to understand, gnosis is a matter of action within oneself. To really accomplish the works of the path, one has to perform the will of the being, the will of God. And in the first portion of the work, that will is the will of our innermost, the will of Atman, that self. If we are always going to another person, a teacher or a friend, to ask advice, to ask what we should do, we will never learn to hear the voice of our being. It's a form of suffering to not know the will of the being. There's no question about that. But it is not an answer to go to an instructor or a teacher to find the will of your being. Your instructor and your teacher will not know the will of your being. They will have their opinion, and it may be an educated one. That does not mean it's right for you. The true initiate, particularly at the moment of facing the decision of the straight or direct path versus the spiral path, has to know the will of his being. That decision, if made from self-will, will inevitably be the spiral path, because the nirvanis are selfish. The person who truly aspires to know what Christic love is has to begin today. Firstly, knowing the will of the being, willing to sacrifice anything to know that will, willing to renounce the urge of the ego to get easy answers, the urge of the ego to always ask the opinions of others, the urge of the ego to not meditate. The real initiate has to learn to carry a burden, and that burden is a cross, and that cross is heavy. We train ourselves daily. We have to learn to measure what we are managing, to always try to take the more difficult step. More difficult in the sense that knowing that there are no easy answers, more difficult in the sense that we have to sacrifice our self-will. This can only be known inside, in ourselves, intuitively and directly through meditation. So, if the initiate, the student, begins from the very beginning to train themselves to act on the will of the being, not any person, not any teacher, not any instructor, not any leader of any movement, but on their own inner being. If they train themselves in that way every day, by the time this person reaches this fifth degree of initiation, they will know what to do. And the will of the being may be, take the spiral path, and that's what they should do. And that's good. But the will of the being may be, take the direct path, and the initiate will say, oh my God, how can I do that? But I must. The only one who can do that is the one who knows how to understand the will of the being. When that happens, that will becomes changed. Because then the will of that initiate becomes merged, becomes impregnated with the will of the Christ. And this is that birth that happens when the Christic energy is born in the heart of that initiate. This is only possible for those who take the straight path, the direct path, or in other words, the path of the bodhisattva. The nirvanis, the pratyekas, never access that experience unless they enter the straight path. That change is tremendous, and it marks the birth of the Son of Man. The Son of Man is the humanization of the cosmic Christ within the person. So when we read this first chapter of the Revelation of John, we understand this is a conversation between the initiate and the Christ who's being born in him. So John writes, it was on the Lord's day, and I was caught up by the Spirit, and behind me I heard a loud voice like the sound of a trumpet, which said to me, write down what you see on a scroll and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. I turned to see whose voice it was that spoke to me, and when I turned I saw seven standing lamps of gold. And among the lamps, one like a son of man, robed down to his feet, with a girdle, golden girdle around his breast. The hair of his head was white as snow-white wool, and his eyes flamed like fire. His feet gleamed like burnished brass refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp, two-edged sword, and his face shone like the sun in full strength. The seven standing lamps of gold are the seven spinal columns of our seven bodies. And these are these five first serpents, five bodies, plus two more on that triangle related to the divine soul and Atman. So the Son of Man appears amongst those seven candlesticks, or the seven serpents of fire. The symbolism is quite deep. So that Son of Man, the Christ, out of his mouth comes a sharp two-edged sword. That sword is the wisdom, the knowledge. That sword is sharp because it cuts through illusion, cuts through the ego, cuts through theory. And it's two-edged because it is both literal and symbolic. And his face shone like the sun in full strength. Strength, of course, is the virtue of Mars. And Mars is closely related, of course, with Samael. The sun is a symbol of the Christ. So we see here this Martian or warrior Christic force. And John continues, when I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. This also is quite symbolic. The initiate, of course, falls at the feet of the Christ out of devotion and humility, but also dead as an ego. But he laid his right hand upon me and said, do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. For I was dead, and now I am alive forevermore, and I hold the keys of death and death's domain. Write down, therefore, what you have seen, what is now, what will be hereafter. Here is the secret meaning of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand, and the seven lamps of gold. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lamps are the seven churches. That symbolism we're going to get into in the next lecture. But the point for today is to understand that in order for us as students of Gnosis to fully grasp and understand the symbolism of this book of Revelation, we firstly have to work on ourselves every day. We have to be putting into practice these teachings. These texts are not made merely to theorize and intellectualize. They are given as an indication of the work we have to perform. In order to accomplish the works that we'll study in this course, we have to be working with it practically. So in this first chapter we see, I fell at his feet as though dead. This is the right approach. This is the right attitude. To comprehend the works that the Christ explains in this book, we have to fall at his feet. We have to humble ourselves. We have to renounce our own self-interest, our own sense of what we think and believe. And it's simple in a way. If you look at it this way, if we already understood the teachings, we would have done it. If we already understood God or Christ, we would not be here. We would not be what we are. So to fall at the feet of the Son of Man is to recognize that we know nothing, and to humble ourselves, and to work towards that death inside. Any questions? Chapter 1. So we've had two weeks of lectures on chapter 1.
Yeah.
So I think in about 4 years we'll finish the book of Revelation at that rate.
Can you talk a little bit about how Master Samael says that in order to work with the second logos we have to be able to forgive the unpleasant manifestations?
Yeah, that's a good point. The second logos, or the Christ, Chokmah, is that force of love and that force of compassion, the force of sacrifice. And that sacrifice is really the giving up of self-will and self-interest for the benefit of others. To do that is difficult. It's difficult on a daily basis to really consider our each action, even to the point of what we feel and think, to measure each thought, each feeling, each action, based upon how it will affect other people. To do that is very difficult, because our habit is to always be in ourselves, thinking about ourselves, what we want, what we need, what we think we need. So in common life, the ease of our existence, this is difficult. So what about when things get hard? What about when we face real difficulty? Naturally, our tendency is to become even more self-obsessed, to complain, to whine.
React.
We react. We react egotistically. So things get a little hard, and we start to feel pain, to feel conflict, to complain about it, to go and talk to our friends about it, to say, oh, it's so bad, this is terrible, this is happening to me, blah, blah, blah. It's all illusion. None of it's real. And we make a mess of it. We make it worse. So what about when it's even worse than that? What about when we're being persecuted? So if we can't even transform when things are easy and manage that with grace and humility and concern for other people, we certainly can't do it when someone is giving us a really unpleasant impression, when we're dealing with a person who's identified. Say, for example, we have a friend, even a family member or someone we admire, who's giving us bad energy, who's giving us a bad impression, who may be doing things that are questionable. How do we react to that? Normally, we react to it out of our own sense of self. Oh, I can't believe him. It's terrible. I can't believe he's like that. What a bad person. Moreover, if that person starts to direct that behavior towards us, it's even worse. We start to react even more strongly, criticizing, gossiping, blaming, attacking. How do we then learn to receive those impressions and to return love? In Buddhism, there's a very profound teaching. It's also present in Christianity, but is not so presented in such a systematic way. But in the Bible, you find verses about this. And the practice is essentially learning how to exchange oneself with another person. Commonly, it's taught as a method of meditation. You meditate. You imagine the person that you want to transform your impressions about them, and you switch places. In your mind, you visualize. What if I were in this person's shoes? Would I be different? What would I feel if I were them? And the point of this is to firstly understand what they are experiencing. But more than that is to understand how you are affecting them. If a person is treating you badly, why? Maybe you deserve it. Maybe you've done something to stimulate that person that way. Or perhaps there's something that you're not seeing. Meditation can show you that. But in its basis, this practice helps us develop more understanding of other people, more patience, and love, to really have compassion for someone else. The thing is, though, that compassion in this sense and love in this sense, the ability to react, to relate to people in the right way, doesn't mean that we're soft. It doesn't mean that we're sweet. It doesn't mean that we just accept the foolishness of other people and we remain silent. It may mean that we have to act. It may mean we have to speak up. It might mean we have to walk away from that person and isolate them. We know very well in Gnosis that if a person is demonstrating negative behaviors, negative emotions, negative thinking repeatedly, we isolate that person out of love. We put that person to the side, not to be mean, not to be cruel, but to isolate the negative energies that they are irradiating, because those negative forces are infectious and damaging. And of course, the isolated person doesn't understand, and they become angry. They become vengeful. They blame, they criticize, they attack, they sabotage, never realizing that what's being done is done out of love. And this happens in Gnostic schools. It happens in spiritual groups. So if you find yourself being isolated, look at yourself. Meditate. Try to understand, why am I being treated this way? Maybe I deserve it. Another question?
Okay, we have a few questions here. let's start with the first one. In that we all have our own particular father who is in heaven, Keter, why is it that some monads, if this can be accounted to Keter, desire self-realization and others don't, when they are all gods?
Every monad has their own idiosyncrasy and has their own will. As to why one would want self-realization and another would not, I have no idea. Another question?
Thanks for that answer.
Sure.
Okay. While studying to understand alchemy, is it better to abstain from union or just jump into alchemy without really understanding what one is doing, spilling once in a while and holding it in once in a while? Is this a form of great tantra, and is this better than spilling all the time?
To really answer that question thoroughly would require a lot of time because it brings up a lot of points. The first thing I'd recommend is that the questioner should study the books, should study the teaching. And the reason is because when we're at the beginning of this work, it takes a certain amount of effort and discipline and will to understand it. But there comes a point at which the student has to make a decision. Do it or don't. To be on the fence is to not only waste one's time, but to cause harm. So I would say that ultimately you have to really comprehend what the teachings mean. And I mean that as something that's in your heart, something that you really understand, not just with the mind. And when you have that understanding, the work becomes normal. It becomes natural. It becomes something that you can't imagine not doing because you understand it. So in terms of how one should practice, you have to listen to your heart. But I mean the part of your heart that's true, the part of your heart that is a little more quiet than the desires that we feel or the passion that we feel. Passion, desire, try to push us towards certain kinds of experiences, certain kinds of sensations. And I think a sincere person will recognize that that desire, that will, tends to lead to trouble. So with that sincerity and with that understanding comes the interest in this teaching and the desire to change. So if you take that as your point of view and pursue it, it seems to me that it would be natural that you will come to the realization that those desires and passions that you feel are only going to lead to trouble. So if you're going to renounce it, do it. And don't go back.
How is it that there are hierarchies among the angels if they are all perfect? Do they reach their particular level after completing the path, or do they reach it while walking and can continue higher?
Okay. We tend to understand the term perfection as an absolute term, and it's not. It's similar to the term truth. There is truth, but there are levels of truth. There's truth in levels according to your own development. So perfection's the same. To reach perfection in the absolute sense is to become a Paramartha Satya. And to reach that level, you pass through other levels of perfection, degrees of perfection. So this is something that you have to understand. You have to firstly remove this sense that perfection is an absolute term and is only one state, because it's not. It has many levels. So all the angels, the Buddhas, all have varying degrees of development which correspond to their degrees of perfection. But none of them are absolutely perfect. until they become paramartha satyas. Does that answer the question? Okay, well, let's go to the next one.
Okay, the next question. If we react to the behavior of a negative person by sending out the energy of love, not the emotion, the energy from the heart chakra, will that help to dissolve the negative energy being sent to you? And can we use this to assist our loved ones?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. The spontaneous and true feeling of compassion is the most perfect form of defense that we have. Nothing can penetrate that. And that's why you read and study these different masters and teachers who were being persecuted terribly, tortured and abused, and yet they always maintain their serenity, and they maintain love towards the person who's abusing them. And they may suffer physically, and they may suffer some emotional, or, you know, they suffer, of course, from the persecution. But that love is so strong, so pervasive, and so radiant that they are not ultimately hurt. They're not ultimately harmed. And that experience becomes a vehicle of change, right? Becomes a way for even the persecutor to become benefited. And there are stories like that in the Bible. For example, Paul, who was persecuting and saw a light. And that light is that light of love, that Christic force, that he realized what a mistake he was making. There are many stories like that. Also in the stories of the Buddha, people who came to the Buddha with great anger and ferocity to attack him, but he responded with so much serenity and love that that person became transformed. So there's no question that by generating compassion and working to cultivate the qualities of the being, we can not only improve our own lives, but improve the lives of other people. And at the same time, have some defense against the unpleasant energies. Next. Oh, your question.
Could you explain the difference between being harmed physically and emotionally and being ultimately harmed?
Right. Well, I think that's a matter of, to understand the different ways that we can be harmed is a deep question. But a simple sort of way, like a synthetic way to answer that would be, real harm has to be related to states of consciousness. And what I mean is that for someone who is an embodiment of the Christ, who is fully irradiating that force, cannot really be harmed. They can be harmed when they become identified. So if that person, let's say a bodhisattva, becomes identified with anger, resentment, or lust, or pride, that immediately opens a door or a gap within which harm can come, and that person can fail. They can create a problem for themselves or a problem for someone else. We're all vulnerable to that until we reach that state of absolute perfection. So a bodhisattva, even though that person may embody the Christic force, is still vulnerable because they still have ego. And so that person is undergoing a tremendous struggle to maintain the presence of that Christic force and to not be identified with the ego. This is very difficult. And, you know, you see that initiates, bodhisattvas, fail. They make mistakes because they are not perfect. They are not the Christ. They're carrying that seed. But until they are that completely, they make mistakes. Unfortunately, for the person who's working in that way, for the person who is a bodhisattva, who's accomplished these degrees of development, it's much more difficult for them, firstly, to see the mistake, and secondly, to act on it. And the reason is, they're working in more and more subtle levels, more and more difficult to perceive and discern. And those egos, those aspects of the psyche, are more and more clever. So this is the reason why the Master Samael and Vior emphasized and emphasized and emphasized repeatedly how important meditation is. It's absolutely essential for the beginner. No question about that. But the beginner struggles. But the beginner is working with very superficial levels of the mind and still doesn't get it. So for the person who's working in more subtle levels, it's way more difficult, much harder. And so the tendency to make a mistake is greater. And the impact of that mistake is greater. Yes?
A good example is in the Bible, right? The two bodhisattvas, the two kings, Saul and David.
Exactly.
Saul failed.
Right. In the Bible, we have the story of Saul and David. And if you read the story, you'll see that. Saul was an initiate, but he became identified with certain parts of his ego, and he failed. And if you look, you see that in many, many examples. How initiates can work and achieve great degrees of development. But why do they fall? Why does a bodhisattva reach such a great height and then fall? Because they still have ego. And they have vulnerabilities that they have yet to transcend. We know, for example, the case of the initiate Solomon, who achieved great heights of comprehension, but failed. That initiate reached a certain stage of development, but did not perceive the deception of some ego, and so entered into mistakes and lost everything. And you see the same case in many other stories. So it's not as simple as once you're walking on the path, you're guaranteed to get there. Once you're a bodhisattva, you're guaranteed to get there. No way. The path is so dangerous, but those dangers are also within our own mind. Does that answer your question? Another question?
When the bodhisattva Samael fell, did another angel take precedence over the ray of strength?
Well, we have to understand something. The being never falls. The intimate, Atman, never falls. The one who's in charge of the ray of strength is the inner God, is the being. And that angel, that entity, that intelligence is always there and is always in charge of that ray. But his son fell, his bodhisattva. So, while the bodhisattva has fallen, the master, the inner master, has to work in different ways, through other vehicles, through other means, through other methods, until his son arises. And likewise with any master. The son, the bodhisattva, may fall, but the master does not.
When one walks the path and completes it, does he become a Paramatta Satya, or is it only achieved by walking the path many times as Master Avaramento did?
To become a Paramatta Satya requires such a degree of knowledge and understanding that very, very few have reached it. There are initiates who rise to a certain point and descend again, rise again, descend again, each time to gather more knowledge in order to ascend a little higher, and on the next try, a little higher. So, generally speaking, that is the nature of the work. The human soul, the bodhisattva, descends or falls, according to the circumstances, in order to achieve more knowledge, more wisdom. And each time they do that, it's more difficult, more painful, more risky, and yet if they do it, they get more knowledge. Some don't dare. They don't risk it. And so their human soul will achieve a certain degree of development and stay there. Yes. That's it?
No. What can you tell us about the Adi Buddha who resides in the unmanifested absolute? Is he beyond the Glorian?
Okay. Adi Buddha is really the absolute, is really that nothingness or that being of the being which resides deep within the essence of all creatures. That Adi Buddha when manifesting, forms this ray of creation. Or in other words, Avalokiteshvara, this force or light of light, love, and compassion. And that force, when it expresses itself further and begins to manifest the spirit and the soul, is the glorion. It is that three in one who's expressing and becomes the glorion. So Adi Buddha is before that, is beyond that, is the essence of that.
Was Samael Ambeor the Dhyani Bodhisattva or the Bodhisattva of Samael Mars? Can you explain the difference between one and the other?
Okay. The Bodhisattva is a vehicle of wisdom. So any initiate, any human soul who chooses from the will of the being to take the direct path becomes a bodhisattva by right. They incarnate that wisdom. When that bodhisattva, that human soul, continues the work and is successful in accomplishing greater heights, working through the second mountain, they enter into the third mountain, they become a logos. That being becomes a logos, right? That initiate then becomes one with the forces of the logos, or that trinity. And that being, that innermost, becomes a logos itself, a cosmo-creator. And that's what makes that bodhisattva a Dhyani Bodhisattva. Dhyani Bodhisattva is the bodhisattva of a logos.
Yeah, we have a very inquisitive group of students today.
That.
The questions keep coming, so I'm just going to keep asking.
That's fine.
When one becomes a logos, does that mean their monad has fused with their own particular intimate Christ and hence it is in communion with the cosmic Christ?
That's right.
Okay, so to go to the next one?
Yes.
What did John mean when he said it was on the day of the Lord?
Well, what do you think the day of the Lord is? Anybody know? Right, Sabbath. Sabbath. Saturday, related to Saturn, related to death. So it's a holy day. It's a day related to the death of the ego. It's a day related to alchemy. And Bina, of course, because Bina is related to Saturn. Bina is the Holy Spirit, so there's a lot of correspondences there.
More? Next. If the work is to reunite with the Christ and to join our particular ray, how does one pass beyond this, if this is what it means to be a Paramartha Satya?
Well, the Paramartha Satya has absolute knowledge, absolute consciousness. This is really beyond even the ray. Because the ray, or the glorion, is the expression of that trinity, right? Keter Hokma Bina. The Paramartha Satya has gone well beyond this and entered into the absolute. So having full knowledge and incorporating the understanding of the ray is happening in the levels of Bina, Hokma, Keter, etc. But to move beyond that is to enter into the knowledge of the Okitanok, the ray of creation, the Ein Sof Or, the Ein Sof and the Ein. And that knowledge is vastly more profound than simply the knowledge of one's own ray.
When people travel out of the body, is this only in the lunar astral plane, or do they also go into the lunar mental plane or even the causal?
Well, you have to understand, firstly, when someone is going out of the body, it just means that all of the different aspects of their psyche are leaving the physical form. So if you look at the Tree of Life and you take the consciousness out of Malkut, you still have a lot of spheres left over. You have all of the spheres of the Klipot, and you have all the superior levels. So then it becomes a question of, where is the person's center of gravity? Is their center of gravity in the ego? Then they are probably wandering around in the infernal worlds. Is their center of gravity in the solar astral body? Then they have the capacity to enter into those realms. So if we as students are asleep and we are struggling to have any kind of experience, then generally speaking, when we have some kind of awakened experience or even a dream, it is in the inferior dimensions. To enter into the superior ones is a work of conscious will.
Is Master Samaelam Beor a Paramatasatya?
Not yet. As far as I know. He said he was working towards that, but who knows?
What level of development do we need in order to travel beyond our galaxy?
You need to have a solar astral body.
What constitutes a universe, and are there many universes?
Each sphere, each sephira, is a world in itself. And each one of those has different levels and aspects. The universes that exist are related to superior levels of the Tree of Life and to the superior worlds of the Kabbalah. So there are many. What's difficult to comprehend is that they are both isolated and interrelated. And to understand that, you have to meditate.
If one has walked the path before, reached self-realization, but fell, and he has lost every other opportunity for the work again, does he return to the Absolute as an elemental, or does he return with whatever development he achieved?
Right. You know, I think to really understand that question, there are some lectures on the website to read about the process of the Ray of Creation and how the transmigration of souls occurs. So that Ray of Creation lecture covers that pretty well, right? So I would say, yeah, I would go into the forum area of the website and take a look in the materials there. There's a lot written about that that will explain it more thoroughly than I can do in the time we have here.
So what can you tell us of Judas Iscariot? Is he a master?
Of course, Judas is a master, a great master of the White Lodge. Unfortunately, I think there are some people who think that what he did was wrong or made a mistake, but we know or understand from the teachings that the role that Judas played in the life of Jesus was sacred and a great honor. So Master Samael explained that Judas Iscariot is working now on behalf of humanity to help humanity.
How is it that a bodhisattva who completed the work and returned to his inner God can make the mistake of falling again if he is already perfect, as his father who is in heaven is perfect?
Because there are levels of development. The thing to understand is this. The bodhisattva, when becoming a bodhisattva, has still only eliminated a very small fraction of the ego. That initiate then has to work very intensely for a long period of time to eliminate the totality of the ego. When that's accomplished, the person is resurrected. They enter into additional levels of work. Even when the ego is dead, we can make mistakes because perfection is achieved in levels. So even the great gods have made mistakes. And this is demonstrated in various mythologies, but also in some stories that the Master Samael explained. Just because one has reached a degree of perfection does not mean that one is infallible. Karma is very complicated, even for the gods. So to understand karma and to act properly at all times is only possible for a paramatasatya. Anyone below that level of development, anyone who's out of the absolute, is in danger of making a mistake. That's all.
Mercurian 2005 wants to say hi to everybody in the room. And then the Rebel Gnostic has another question, so we're going to go with one more.
Okay, this is the last one.
Okay, is the Absolute an entity trying to reach realization of itself through the work of its monads?
The Absolute is beyond conception. It is uncreated light. It is a kind of intelligence, a kind of force that needs to know itself. It does not have attributes, but it manifests through attributes in order to acquire self-knowledge. So to understand what that means requires a lot of meditation. It's not something that you can simply say, the Absolute is a being who feels this and that. It isn't that simple. It's very, very difficult for our intellect to understand what the Absolute is and is not. Okay.
Any further questions you could address to the forum?
That's good. Yes, thank you. I'm glad everybody was so enthusiastic. And I'm sure you'll come up with even harder questions for next week's lecturer. So thank you very much.